Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now,
Stan here with you on this Thursday morning, though, and right now it's time to talk science and say hello, Dr. Carl.
Hello, Dr. Carl, and hello, Dr. Zan.
Hello, doctors everywhere around the country. We're talking science for the next hour. Dr. Carl, it's all yours. 1-300-055-36 if you've got a question for him. If you can't get through and you have any answers for us, then you can get through a couple of other ways. You can text us on 1975-755 with your answers. You can tweet at Dr. Carl, D-O-C-T-O-R-K-A-R-L, or you can leave a message on the Triple J forum, triplej.net.au. Shall we get into some questions, Dr. Carl?
Lay them on me.
All right. Emma's in Adelaide. You're up first, Emma. Good morning.
Morning.
What's your question?
My optometrist told me that when I sleep, I don't close my eyes properly. Like, they are mostly closed, but just the bottom's a little bit open. And that's why when I wake up, I often have really dry eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering why I don't close my eyes.
The eyelid shut is a balance of two forces. You have a muscle called the orbicularis something or other, which is a bad memory on my part, which is like a circular muscle. And when it contracts, it tends to push the two eyelids together. Then separately, you have muscles on the upper eyelid and muscles on the lower eyelid that try to pull them apart. The balance is set, in your particular case, is it on one eye or both eyes, Emma?
I think it was on both eyes. I'm not really sure. It's just when I had an eye test, they could see that I didn't close it properly.
Right. So that means that the balance is set such that the lower eyelid tends to stay open. This can range, in terms of being a problem, from zero to lots. And so what you need to do is then be seen by your local doctor. And it's very important that you have one local doctor who knows you and who knows your body well over a period of time, and then get bounced onto an ophthalmologist, an eye doctor, a surgeon, who will then keep an eye on you. And if it ends up that you leave your eyes open at night a lot, your eyelid dries out and you get scarring of the cornea, then it may be worthwhile doing something about it. The something could range all the way from nothing to eye drops that are sort of gloopy and jelly that will just do you through the whole night, all the way up to maybe surgery. The thing is that in the cornea, which is perfectly transparent, there are seven layers of cells.
Okay.
At the bottom is a membrane called Descemet's membrane, D-E-S-C-E-M-E-T apostrophe S membrane. You can damage the first couple of layers and they will repair. If you scar the bottom layer, it's scarred forever.
Okay.
So the thing is just to put yourself into the medical system and then just float through and keep an eye on it. You just don't want to damage the Descemet's membrane, that's all.
Hey, thanks for the call, Emma.
Thank you.
See you later. James is calling in from Newcastle. Hi, James.
Hello.
Hello, what's your question?
Just wondering about sometimes when I go to bed, lying in bed, as I'm falling asleep, I'll have like a little bit of a random dream. And I'll kick, like, or I'll trip over something in the dream and like stumble and it'll wake me up and I'll be like, halfway through a kick or something. I'm wondering, what's the go with that?
Well, when you're dreaming, you're supposed to be paralyzed, so you can't act out your dreams. And the wiring in your brain that paralyzes most of you, it doesn't want to paralyze your heart or your lungs, but the wiring that paralyzes most of you is not totally paralyzing all of you. And it's just a little bit of residual neuromuscular innervation. In other words, the ability for your nerves to work your muscles. There's still a bit of that neuromuscular innervation still okay. A little bit doesn't hurt. I have a family relative who every now and then is woken by his wife to say, "Stop strangling me around the neck with your hands." So if you're...
He's strangling her in his sleep?
Yeah, in his sleep.
Whoa.
So providing you don't get to that stage and you're not walking around the house setting fire to it or going down to the kitchen, and people have done this and make bacon, raw bacon and tobacco sandwiches.
Oh.
So long as you don't do that. And people have been getting burns from cooking at night and not noticing what they're doing.
Wow.
So that's the whole range of sleepwalking thing. And I think there's been a few cases where people have killed people while sleepwalking. And there was one just about a year ago. Very rare. So you're at the very, very soft end of that, Dr. James. Keep an eye on it. Bring it to the attention of your local doctor. Always keep the same doctor.
Thanks for the call, James.
Jess.
See you later.
See you, Dr. Jess.
Jeff's calling in from Brisbane this morning. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you going?
Good. What's your question?
I'm just wondering about when you clean your ears out with cotton buds, how come it feels good?
It does feel good because you know you're doing God's work by removing those little bits of brown egg, earwax and then disposing of them properly, whatever that is, usually into the nearest garbage bin, as opposed to having them come out naturally, appearing when you don't want them to appear, just on the outside of your outer ear, and then people come up and see this bit of brown wax and go, "Yeah." On the other hand, there is a possibility you can push too hard against your eardrum and damage it. If you go to the eardrum and with a tattoo needle, tattoo it with a tiny little dot of ink and then watch it every day, you'll see that it gradually sweeps out a spiral from the center of the eardrum round and round and round until it hits the wall of the ear canal and then migrates out. So normally earwax will come out by itself. But on the other hand, it feels good, and I don't know why. I failed you in answering that one, Dr. Jeff.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. What's your feeling on ear candling, Dr. Carl, when you can, you know, you go to health food stores and you get those kind of tubes that you're supposed to sort of stick in your ear and suck out the wax? Are we supposed to have a certain amount of wax in our ears as a base level?
Yes, it's there as a protective. It has antibiotic properties, antifungal properties. It stops bad guys from getting in there and colonising it. You have a certain background level of good guy bacteria, fungi living in there. You don't want the bad guys there. My understanding of ear candling is that it's not really encouraged.
Okay.
It's sort of negative vibe about it a bit.
I find that when I go to gigs and if I happen to not have my earplugs with me and the gig's fairly loud, the next day I've got quieter, and this is oversharing, but, you know, we're talking science, I've got more... It feels like I've got more wax in my ears. Does the body sometimes compensate for the fact that there's loud, potentially damaging decibels of sound and then produce more wax to try and, protect the eardrum from that noise? Is that possible?
You won't manufacture earwax so rapidly.
Yeah.
It comes from special glands. But any earwax that you might have there could be shaken because the eardrum will be vibrating enormously and causing damage. Mm. Oh, your poor little ears. I'm so glad that I've managed to get both my son and my daughter a good set of speakers because the quality of sound that you get through the little earbuds is terrible. And so now that I've got them good speakers, which are not enormously expensive, just better than crap, they can actually say, "Oh, listen to the cymbals," and they can hear what the musician intended. So people, when you go to gigs, wear, as Zan does, earplugs, and like me, wear industrial earphones on top of that. And I do look a bit like a dork, I'm sorry.
Dean in Cheltenham's got a question for us. Hi, Dean.
Hi, Dr. Zan. Hi, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Dean.
Hi, Dr. Dean.
My question is about weeing or urination.
Yep.
I've noticed every year when I go away camping at Easter time, I have to get up in the middle of the night, or not in the middle of the night, but early in the morning, earlier than normal, to get up to have a wee. And I never, ever have to do this when I'm at home or, you know, on the weekends, you know, regardless of what activities I've been partaking in during the day, I can always get through the night. But camping, I can't. Why would that be?
Let me ask you a few questions. Firstly, is it cold at night when you're camping?
It can be. At Easter bush, it can be cold, yes.
Okay. Second question, do you drink more water or beer or other liquids than normal?
Yes, generally.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm reckoning that it's a combination of two factors. One, you tend to sit around and be convivial and sit around the campfire and talk and drink. But secondly, the lower air temperature causes your blood vessels in your skin to close down, called vasoconstriction. You're still you're still pumping as much blood through your body, so more of it goes through your kidneys. The kidneys will then filter the urine out, and because there's more blood going through the kidneys, they'll generate more than the average, which is roughly 1 mil of urine per kilogram of body weight per hour. So if you're an 80-kilogram male, you make 80 mils per hour. Your bladder capacity is 400, 500, depending. And you can, you know, it increases, it varies during the day, less at night. But I'm reckoning a combination of the cold air plus the increased liquid leads to that.
Uh-huh. I work on the road, so I've got a related question. Sometimes I can be driving around and I'll be busting and I'm hanging on, trying to get to the next job to find a toilet. And then once I get there, I don't tend to have too much going on. You know, it's not as much as I thought it would be, being I was busting.
Well, what you can do is you can train your bladder. Your bladder has stretch receptors in the wall, and as you get more volume of urine in there, and we've done this on our Sleek Geeks TV show, we discussed this weeing episode. We even have a wonderful song for you at the end, which will just make you laugh so much you want to wee anyhow. So what happens is that you stretch the stretch receptors. They say, take me now, and then it's not an emergency, and then you say, no, back in the box, ignore you, stay back, I'm in control, I'm a master of my own destiny, and then they back off, sending so much signals to the brain, or your brain just says, you can hang on for a bit longer, and then the second or third time it comes, you've really, really got to go. But the first time you can just control it, and this is good to train your bladder so that in later life you don't have to go to the toilet all night.
Thanks for the call, Dean.
Excellent. Thank
See you,
you.
Later. Bye-bye. It really is quite painful when you've, for example, staying at a music festival, you've had a fairly big night the night before, and then you've got to crawl out into the dewy, very cold early morning and drag yourself off to the toilets feeling worse for wear.
And not knowing where everything is either.
It's true. Scott's calling in from Ballina this morning. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. What's your question?
Wind. What is it actually made from? Is it the air pressures or is it something completely different?
You tend to get various wind patterns happening constantly around the pattern due, and as you got it right, due to different air pressures. Look up on Wikipedia the thing called a Hadley, H-A-D-L-E-Y cell. So basically, the sun shines hottest because it's square onto the equator at the equator. The air rises. It then splits and goes north and south to about 20 or 30 degrees north and south, and then falls. It then falls down dry without the moisture because it's come out as clouds between 0 and 20 degrees from the equator, and then you tend to have the deserts. It then flows across the surface, then goes up. So you've got a flow of air going directly from the equator to the poles. It's heading in that direction, but it's going up and down, up and down, but it's heading directly towards the equator. Then you have the spin of the Earth. This gives you a consistent wind, so that if you're flying in Australia from Sydney to Perth, as I did, the 4.5-hour flight, we hit winds so strong that we had to go up to 40,000 feet, which I've never seen before. Normally it's 30 to 35,000, and we had to go up to 40,000, and instead of cutting across Adelaide, we went a couple of hundred kilometres south, and we were still, instead of 4.5 hours, it took us 5 hours 20, and earlier this week, on the Monday, it took 5 hours 50. So it's a combination of different air pressures, plus the Hadley cells, plus Coriolis effect, all of them lead to different pressures, which means that air tends to flow from here to there. We call the impression of the air flowing on our faces wind.
Makes sense, Scott?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. See you later. Jack's calling in from Thornbury this morning. Hi, Jack.
G'day, Zane. G'day, Dr. Carr. How are you going?
Very well.
Look, I was just wondering whether it's harder to swim in fresh water than it is to swim in salt water.
Yes, it is harder because the water is less buoyant and so you tend to sit lower in the water. Now, if you are totally underwater, then you can swim better. If you're sitting higher in the water, you can swim better. But it's when you're at the surface and you're a little bit lower that you swim worse. And there have been various problems at various Olympic Games where people doing the breaststroke would kick off, and this was years ago, would kick off from the wall and then travel 25 metres underwater doing another stroke before they had to come to the surface and do their breaststroke and then win in that particular event. So at the surface, the higher you are, the better. But if you're totally underwater, you're swimming even better again because you're not mixing air and water.
Right, so, yep.
Thanks for the call, Jack.
No, can I just ask you one more thing, Dr. Carl?
Well, we've got a lot of callers to get to, Jack. Is it a related question?
I just want to say, Dr. Carl, can you tell Tim that he's wrong? Just say Tim's wrong.
No. Because we don't know what the question is. Good on you, mate. All right, Mitchell from Adelaide, hello.
G'day. How are you, Dr. Zan? How are you, Dr. Carl?
Very
Dr.
well.
Mitchell?
We're being led astray by our listeners. What's your question for us, Mitchell?
I'm just wondering how precise carbon dating is in relation to dinosaurs.
Oh, they don't use carbon dating with dinosaurs because the carbon dating runs out after about 10 half-lives, and the half-life of carbon is about 5,700 years, so call it 57,000, 60,000 years. They use other forms of dating, other forms of radioactive dating. Now, with regard to dinosaurs, you'll notice that they tend to refer to the different periods of dinosaurs as not so many million years ago, but Jurassic and Cretaceous and Triassic. And that's because when they were wandering around these particular mountains in the province of Perm in Russia, they kept on seeing these characteristic rocks. So they said, these are Permian rocks. And when they saw these other rocks that always looked the same, the first time they noticed them was near the Jura, J-U-R-A mountains, I think in Switzerland. So they were Jurassic rocks. And then they were seeing in other places Cretaceous rocks. Well, that's when the carbon dioxide balance changed and lots of chalk deposited from the oceans, and the German word for chalk is, the Latin word for chalk is cret. And so the way they firstly dated rocks, the dinosaurs, and they appeared in three periods of time from 220 million years ago to 60 million years ago, 65. They appeared in that period from 220 to 65 million years ago, they appeared in three distinct periods. The first way they dated them was just how the rocks looked, which were Triassic, where you had three characteristic layers of rock, Jurassic after the Jura Mountains, Cretaceous after the chalk. And then other forms of radioactive dating, not carbon dating, but other forms allowed them to date them more accurately. Are you asking, is your back question, is your backstory, is the world older than 6,000 years, or are you talking about the Noah's Ark of carbon dating, or what?
Yes, in relation to the world.
The world being older than 6,000 years?
Yes.
Okay, that particular story goes back to the Bishop of Usher, who was a really, really clever guy. And using the best data that he had, which was the Bible, and it provides an excellent genealogical record, plus archaeological evidence of the time, and there was no geology at that time, he came up with a series of dates, and then he worked back, was able to work out that the world was, with the best data that he had in the 1600s or 1500s, he worked out the world was roughly 6,000 years old, which was totally wrong, but that was the best he could do with the data he had. It got his annotations of the ages of various biblical characters accidentally got put into a Bible. Now, it wasn't the Bible going back 2,000 years ago. It was a human living in the United Kingdom type area, the Bishop of Usher. And but because it got put into the Bible, as a side note down the side of the pages, people thought it was a direct word of God, not this guy, the Bishop of Usher. But the world is, that's how that, I've written about it on the ABC Great Moments in Science homepage. So if you look up Dr. Carl Great Moments in Science, you'll see a story about it. And I've also written about it in one of my books, but you can get it for free on the ABC homepage.
Hey, thanks for the call, Mitchell.
Thank you.
See you later, mate. Mitchell. Hi, Scott.
G'day, how are you?
Good, what's your question?
Just a question about baby's anatomy, really. My wife and I have noticed with our 14-month-old son that he's starting to get an erection every now and then on the change table. And I do remember a while ago, this was before I had kids, that Dr. Carr was talking about the baby's bodies do little test runs to make sure all the equipment works, but I thought that was closer to birth, not around the age of one.
Yeah, look, thank you, Dr. Scott. That's correct. When the baby boys and girls are born, they have virtually zero levels of testosterone, estrogen, really, really low. And around 1 week of age, they kick in and go to teenage levels. And just to test the system, then it switch, I think that that's what it is, then it switches off again. And your boy is having that happening. It happened to my boy. Hi, little Carl, how are you?
Happy yeah, but it, you? Yeah, at about... you're saying it's closer to birth rather than... Because he's just over 1 year old now.
That's the major one. But I also noticed it happening at other times. So maybe the system is checking itself further down the line.
Oh, well, there you go.
And I don't think this is at all a worry.
No, he doesn't seem too bothered by it. He's quite happy by it.
Yeah, they love playing with
pretty
it.
Happy about it.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I've got a new body part. It's fun. Look, when you go in for your next baby checkup, mention it and hear the latest data. I'm a bit out of date with that, and I'll be very interested to hear what they say. If you can ring us back and tell us what they find, and I'll go looking at my end as well.
Thanks for the call, right. Scott.
I'll let you know. Thank you.
See you later, mate.
Bye.
Ollie's calling you from Port Macquarie. Hi, Ollie.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. You've been working out with your wife around the neighbourhood.
We do walk the dog and our baby and stuff, and we had a disagreement about walking on the exact same circuit. She reckons if you walk one way, one direction versus the other direction, that you burn more energy one way than you do the other, and I would maintain that it's exactly the same. She reckons that the gradient on the hills are steeper one way than they are the other, but they're longer.
And how far do you walk?
Oh, not that far, like just around the neighbourhood.
And would that be a kilometre, 100 metres?
Yeah, probably a kilometre.
And are there any hills involved?
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Okay. If, now this is a big if you had a perfect storage mechanism for energy, so that when you went down the hill, you could store the energy and use it to go back up the hill, if there would be the same amount of energy burnt walking around the neighbourhood. But you don't have a perfect amount of way of storing it. So depending on the gradient of the hill, sometimes you burn up a lot of energy going down a hill, if it's a steep hill. But if it's a shallow hill, you don't burn up hardly any energy at all.
Yeah.
But going up a hill, you're always burning up energy.
But aren't you going up and down the same number of hills regardless of which way you go?
Well, okay. You're going up. If you're going down a steep hill, then you're using less energy than going up going down a less steep hill, isn't that right, Dr. Carl?
That's right. So suppose you walk down a shallow hill. You're hardly burning any energy at all. But coming up it, you have to burn energy. But walking down a steep hill, you have to burn up lots of energy. So it's not symmetrical. Going up and down a steep hill, you're burning energy each direction. You're burning the most going up, and you're burning a moderate amount of energy going down a steep hill.
There you go.
But going down a shallow hill, you're hardly burning any energy at all. So it's not a symmetrical situation. You can feel your leg muscles tensing.
I'm afraid
your wife is right on this one, I think.
Thanks for the call, Ollie.
But I'm not an expert in this. The person who is a world expert is letter R, then middle name McNeil, and then the last name Alexander. If somebody can email him and ask him what he thinks, I'd be ever so thrilled.
Just find him online.
I'll accept defeat until then.
Well, that's just a guess. You see. Just
accepting
a guess.
Defeat. Thanks for the call, Ollie. John's calling in from Bond Beach. Whereabouts is Bond Beach, John?
Just down near Frankston.
Oh, okay, in Victoria. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Frankston. My question is the Great Ocean Conveyor. I want to find out if it does stop as predicted, does the world go into an ice age? And if so, what happens to Australia? Because most of the information I've got at the moment is only based on the Northern Hemisphere.
You're talking about the so-called thermohaline current?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly
and where have you been getting your information from?
All from TV. Documentaries.
You're getting a start. It's more complicated than that. The thermohaline current, thermo means heat, haline means salt. Imagine that it loops around the world. It carries chunks of water the size of continents every second. Imagine that you're starting, say, at the equator, you head up past Spain, and there's lots of heat, you keep Spain warm, and you keep northern Europe and you keep the east coast of the USA warm. It then proceeds north and is hit by the ice water melting, the cold water melting, the fresh water melting coming south, and it chucks a UE. Comes down across down to the bottom, over the equator, the bottom of the Earth, heads across the bottom of the Indian Ocean, it throws a little loop into the Indian Ocean, goes past the bottom of Australia, up into the Pacific, and then does a big loop around there, and then comes back through that gap between the top of Australia and the bottom of New Guinea, Indonesia. If that current switches off, then you no longer get warm water keeping Europe and North America warm. In November 2004, it switched off for 11 days, and we have no idea why. And if it stayed switched off, if it had stayed switched off, you would not be able in 2000, this was a few years ago, you would not be able to grow crops that we do now in Europe and North America. But after 11 days, it switched on again, and we have no idea why. So you can have the weird situation that you have global warming on average. It's greater at the poles than it is at the equator, and the flow of cold, fresh water switches off the thermohaline current in the North Atlantic, which means that while on average the world is getting warmer in a few local areas, North America on the east coast and Europe on the west coast, it gets colder. Not a global cooling. I do not know what the predictions are for it being switched off for Australia, because it wouldn't be just a straight switching off. You'd have a different current going somewhere else, and we're trying to work out what's happened in the past from global records, and it's really hard, and it's made even harder by the amount of the paucity, the fewness of data sensors that we have in the ocean.
Okay.
So we're mucking around with a big system we don't understand.
It's a big question. Okay. Hey, thanks for the call, John.
No worries, thank you,
John. See you later. Dean's calling in from Traralgon. Hi, Dean.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Thanks for staying on the line. What's your question?
Just a quick question about the pelvic floor muscle or the PC muscle. Mm-hmm. If you actually exercise that, does it improve the sexual performance or experience?
For men or women?
Yeah. Both.
Okay. Dr. Yeah. Powell.
Well, that's the pubococcygeus muscle is one of them, PC muscle, going down here in the pelvis, and there's a bunch of other ones. And the overall principle is that anything, on one hand, anything making those muscles better is better for your sex life, so that you've got some degree over your groinal musculature. But don't forget what that great philosopher Frank Zappa said, which is that your brain is your main sexual muscle. That's where sex happens, in your brain. It's your main sexual organ. So, yes, on one hand, definitely for the physical side of it, having better pelvic floor muscles does help. And by the way, don't feel bad about having a good sex life and enjoying it. It's not just terrorists that have sex. Regular people have it as well.
That's how we're all made. Thanks for the call, Dean.
Thanks, guys.
I actually saw a show last night. My good pals Max and Nicole decided to introduce me to the world of Embarrassing Illnesses, which is the name of a program where a whole bunch of interesting illnesses come up, and it's a UK show that they basically film these consultations between doctors and people who have these embarrassing illnesses. And there was an elderly woman who came onto the show, and she had something called prolapse, which is very much related to the pelvic floor not being exercised. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That will probably put the fear of not doing pelvic floor muscles into everyone, Dr. Carl.
Well, you can actually have uterine prolapse. You can have parts of your body pushing out through the little holes that you have at the bottom of your trunk. In the case of the male, you have a few openings there because the genitalia are external. And so in the case of a male, and this is not necessarily related to pelvic floor muscles, you can have hernias in the testes. And I have seen a testicle maybe 1.5 times the diameter of a grapefruit.
Whoa.
Yeah, pretty big, huh?
Whoa,
that was fun. And in the case of women, they can have the uterus beginning to prolapse down through into the vagina and then even pushing out into the outside world.
That's what I saw last night on the television.
Yes, and this can be related to a combination of factors, mainly difficult childbirth, tearing muscles and them not being repaired later, and or pelvic floor training. It's a complicated area. See a local doctor about it. Follow on from there.
Kim in Sydney, you've got a question for Dr. Carl. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for taking this phone call. I've actually been meaning to ask you this question for quite some time now. Mm-hmm. Basically, I wanted to know if you're not on the contraceptive pill and your menstruation cycle is not fixed, why is it that when you are spending some more time with other women, that your cycle is in sync? Because I find that a lot of my girlfriends, or if I'm spending a lot of time with them, or if I'm spending a lot of time with my mother, I know my friends have this with their sisters. Why is it that this cycle are in sync?
Yeah, I've heard this too, Dr. Carl. Is there a scientific reason?
Firstly, with regard to no oral contraceptive in there. The original story was that it was due to chemicals coming out of armpits, and that's been the standard belief from the early 80s until now. And I've just come across a book that says, no, you're all totally wrong. And so I've ordered that book and I've got to read that. So the answer is I don't know until I finish reading that book. But when you're on the oral contraceptive pill, the OCP, your menstrual cycle is driven by, number one, the day you started, and number two, how many tablets there are in a packet. And you just follow that through and you get a sort of a pseudo menstrual cycle. So the only way you'll have synchrony is if you all started taking your tablets on the same day.
But my question was, if you're not on the contraceptive pill and it's a natural cycle and you, that's where I find you kind of get in sync. Because I understand when you're on the pill, it's fixed. So when you're not on the pill, it's not fixed.
Yes, well, so, it's the pheromones, supposedly from the armpits. And the famous experiment done in the early 80s was that there was a woman in San Francisco who was famous slash notorious for the fact that whenever another woman would move into the same flat as her, she would then synchronize with this woman. She was some sort of driver. And they did the experiment where they got this woman to wear cotton pads in her armpits, and then she'd drop the cotton pads off at a laboratory, and they'd get the cotton pads with her armpit sweat, put them in a beaker of alcohol, and then get volunteers in who were female, who were not on a pill, who were not gay, who were not pregnant, etc., etc., and then drop essence of armpit from this woman on the upper lip of these volunteers. And within a couple of months, all of these volunteers were synchronizing with this woman whom they never met, except to receive underneath their nose a drop of her essence of armpit every second day.
Lucky them. So it is all about pheromones.
Yes, but then wow. There's a book saying that the whole pheromone thing is crap, and the word pheromone comes from the roots phero, meaning afar, and moan, to excite. So as opposed to hormones, which excite within your body, pheromones excite outside the body. So when ants are going to find food and they come back, they squirt down a pheromone trail, and other ants come along and smell that trail and then follow it back.
There you go. All right, thanks for the call, Kim.
Thanks for that, guys.
See you later. Simon in Chermside, you've got a theory for us?
Yeah.
Hi. What's your theory?
Oh, it's a bit of a question. I had a theory for the question.
Go ahead.
So, you know, they've proven that everybody flips out when it's a full moon.
Yes.
No, haven't proven
well,
that, but go
people
on.
Say that.
Well, they say that. My old man was a copper and he used to say it too. So, but anyway, I was thinking, you know how the tides change with the moon because they're attracted to the moon? You know how they get higher?
Yeah, 2/3 of the high tide come from the moon, 1/3 comes from the sun, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, do we, you know, if you go off the fact that we do flip out when it's a full moon, is that because we've got so much water in our bodies that it makes us flip out too? Because when it's a full moon?
Well, there's no proof that people flip out on a full moon.
Oh, well if there was, if they do.
If pears were oranges, then car engines would be house bricks.
I've been trying to get through for weeks thinking you would solve this problem for me.
Well, okay.
And you've got no answer for me.
The best data I've been finding, looking at the various studies from emergency rooms, show there's no real increase in admissions on full moons.
They said on telly the other day there was. Was that a lie? Remember on a TV show, on advertising it?
Was it a government TV show or was it commercial TV?
Oh, it was one of those news shows.
Commercial or government?
Oh, commercial, I think.
Not ABC?
No, not ABC. No.
Look, they do tend to say things that are not entirely correct. Look, when I was a taxi driver, I noticed that you used to get more fares on a full moon, and you get the biggest fares when it's a full moon and it stays fine weather until they go out, and then around 9 o'clock at night, if it starts raining, then it's a terrific night. Now, the only reason there's a full moon is that people are walking from one place to another and they're saying, wow, I can see without the streetlights, and you keep on walking. It's as simple as that. But it's not anything gravitational that acting on the tide. The tide's a whole different ballpark. And then I keep on reading studies saying, well, maybe there is an increase in admissions to emergency rooms. Maybe there isn't. And if the effect is that weak, well, it's really insignificant. It's not like it stands out like smoking causes lung cancer and all sorts of diseases. That's really easy to see in the data. But if there is an effect on admissions to emergency rooms on a full moon, it's really a tiny, tiny effect, maybe 1%, maybe 2%, you know. And so you've got to do big studies.
Hey, thanks for the call, Simon. Sorry, we couldn't give you the answer that you're after.
I'm sorry,
Simon. Water and it has nothing to do with, like, the moon or anything like that.
Nothing to do with the gravitational thing, if there is
an effect. God, how disappointing. All right, fair enough.
Thanks for the call, mate.
Life is like that.
See you later. Andy's calling in from Currumbin. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Andy.
Good morning. How are you, Doctor?
Good. What's your question?
I'm a welder, and I use a lot of sun cream on the inside of my elbows to stop the burns.
Oh, that's very clever.
I put it on every day, though, and I was wondering...
So what, if you don't put the sun... Because the skin on the inside of your elbows hardly gets any sun exposure, so it's really tender. So when you were doing... I'm guessing this is some sort of electric MIG or TIG welding. Did you get burns on the inside of your elbows from the UV, from the welding?
Yeah, it's from the infrared and UV. It's off a TIG welder.
Man, you must be doing so much, but you must be doing so much welding.
I do. I weld all day.
Jeez. And you were getting burns. Was it red in colour?
Yes, yeah.
you're actually getting skin colour changes. So it's not the infrared. Well, I think it'd be mainly the ultraviolet, because I've seen nasty burns on eyes in casual, in emergency departments from... Okay, so you're using sunblock, yep, go on.
Yeah, I'd apply it 3 times a day.
Yeah.
I'd put it on pretty thick, and I was wondering, is there any side effects from using so much sun cream on the skin? And just recently, too, my elbows have been getting sore, like the joints on the inside of my elbows.
Ah, okay, with regard to sunscreens, if you use a straight barrier sunscreen, and you can ask your chemist about that, nothing penetrates through the barrier of the thick white cream, and none of the cream penetrates into your skin.
Okay.
That's case number one.
Yep.
Case number two, if you get a nicotine patch and stick it on your skin, it's all set up so that the fine chemical, so that the chemical, the nicotine, will invade your skin and go into your bloodstream.
Uh-huh.
So it is possible for chemicals to pass through your skin into your bloodstream. Three, some sunscreens can be absorbed by the skin. So I'd go to your chemist, tell the chemist your situation, and then go for the one that's a straight barrier. The arthritis is an entirely different story, or it might be related, but I'd go and see your GP, and once again, have one GP who knows you, who knows your body. If you get tired of them, get a second opinion, get all your files sent across to that GP, but tend to have one GP who can put all the data together. Otherwise, if you see different GPs, it falls through the cracks. And can you let us know if the, ring back and let us know, is the arthritis related, and it might take you months to find this out, or is it a completely separate problem?
Okay.
Thanks for the call,
Thank
Andy. Let's see how you go.
Can I just say that I hang out every week for the show? Thank you.
No worries. Thanks for the call, mate.
So many tradies listen to the show.
Yeah, if you ever do miss out on any of the show, don't forget you can download the podcast, triplej.net.au. Dr. Carl is on demand, as you like it, whenever you like it, at the J website. And he's going to be back with you live and talking science on Thursday morning next week. We'll see you then, Dr. Carl.
That's right. In the last 30 seconds, if you look on a Twitter homepage, there's a guy who's written about the ear candling and who says that it does not cause suction. Thank you very much, Mr. Veritas, Curat, Mr. or Mrs. Thank you.
Thank you for everyone for taking part. Thanks, Carl.